So before we go to questions, I'll just note that whenever I give this talk, it's very understandable. People immediately try to figure out what their attachment style is. First of all, no need. You probably will have a sense if you have some degree of secure attachment, because you'll be able to either move forward in your life and work and creative endeavors with a great deal of confidence, or you'll be able to connect in reliable, lasting, secure relationships. If you don't feel those qualities, then it's chances there's some degree of insecure attachment, whether it's anxious or avoidant or disorganized, doesn't really matter that much, because the way we address each of those is the same. And it also, we all have multiple internal working models. So for example, while my father was a rather unpredictable, unreliable, violent alcoholic with mood dysregulation, I had actually a very secure, pretty secure relationship with my mom. So throughout my life, I've been able to be in long-term relationships, core relationships, but my interactions with men growing up was one of complete dysfunction. Generally hung out with the most extreme, felt most comfortable in hanging around guys where there'd be a lot of conflict and rogue behavior. Took years to treat that. So we all have multiple attachment styles, and we even have attachment styles depending upon our relationship with our siblings or other relatives. So, but in general, very, you know, if they're the core caregiver or one of the dominant caregivers was, the relationship was insecure, then we will see a spike in either addictive or compulsive self-auto-regulating behaviors, like food addiction, shopping addictions, internet addictions, and so forth. Attempts to down-regulate our affect states without relying on another human being. So that's about it. We have time now for any questions you'd like to ask or anything you'd like to have. Hi. There's actually a...
Hello? I'd also might ask everyone, when you're using the mic, to, like, it's an ice cream cone. You have to be pretty
clear. Yes. And to identify yourself, give your social security number.
Hi. Name's Alex. Thank you. I told you at the break, I've heard this podcast probably a dozen times. I listen to Dharma Punk's podcast very often, very helpful. Full disclosure, I have 10 years of continuous recovery, and I am have anxious attachment. I'm done. I'm finished. And I'm with an avoidant.
Mm.
And I have a question. I have two questions. One question is disorganized. Is that the same as fearful avoidant?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I'd love for you to speak a little more to the relationship between the avoidant and the anxious attached, and that how that dance plays out, and is that ever something that can find peace?
So in many ways, the anxious and avoidant trap is one of the most common and is one of the most difficult to address. The anxious avoidant trap, where somebody who's anxious attachment, somebody who's avoidant dismissive attachment, wind up in a ongoing drama of get-together, things not working, distance-seeking, then the anxious person becomes preoccupied. The avoidant doesn't really care. They just wait until their needs for sex or some form of appreciation raises, and then they go back together. And then, so each actually recreates the core drama of childhood for each other. The anxious child grew up in an environment where the caregiver they felt the safest with was not available reliably. So, for instance, I'm not implying that there's any gender for any attachment, so I'm just going to use an example. But so a little girl grows up, there's a divorce in the family, the father is available only once in a while, maybe on weekends or at times, and the child, she feels at times overwhelmed by, engulfed by her mother's disappointment at the divorce. So she yearns to be with or have greater access to the father. When the father comes there, because he's no longer the primary caregiver, he can be just the one who comes in with the gifts and the fun, different things to do. So the child is whisked away for a little while from the domestic life with her mother, but then she's deposited right back again in that situation where she doesn't feel she has access to both caregivers. So she begins to have a preoccupied attachment with her father. She yearns for the attachment, but doesn't really know when it's going to come about. Doesn't always has the sense that it's going to end. So is her sympathetic nervous system goes into hypervigilance. She learns to read the micro expression of adults around her, expecting abandonment. She learns to read the micro muscles in the mother's eyes, because she waits to see whenever the mother becomes emotionally depressed or anxious. So, and now let's look at her partner, the male child who grows up in a perhaps a similar situation. He finds, too, the presence of being with the mother unpleasant. The mother's emotions make him feel engulfed. So he just wants to minimize his need, his contact with the mother. So these two children grow up to be adults and they meet. They will feel a sense of electricity or drama or sparks or magic, because all of the early attachment experiences will activate and light up their right hemisphere. They'll be excited because they are now fully in what Freud called a repetition compulsion, where they are repeating the core childhood drama. They will feel excited, but of course, in this example, the male will feel the need to get away as soon as possible once he's had sex or whatever. In this case, the woman will feel preoccupied and want greater attachment. She really wants emotional intimacy. At the beginning of the relationship, she might trade sex for intimacy to try to solidify the attachment, even though she really wants emotional co-regulation. So they get involved in this ongoing dance. And then once in a while, the guy will send a text, something like, "What's up?" That's the lure. And then in her mind, oh, he really, it's like the excitement of the return of the father. The key, I mean, so there's different opinions in attachment theory. Some attachment theorists like Amir Levine believe that there's no possibility of the anxious avoidant, that one person in a relationship has to be secure for it to work out. On the other hand, some very famous couples counselors, Hervil Hendricks and Mago therapy, certainly some of the neuropsychologists who've written on attachment, Amra Gilead, Dan Brown, Sam Elliott wrote Attachment Disturbances in Adults. They don't necessarily write off the possibility of the anxious avoidant working out, but both have to be willing to work on creating a secure relationship by emphasizing the learning how to both emphasize the what their needs are to feel secure. For the avoidant, it will be enough time for distance seeking and to be able to be self-reliant and have a life of their own. For the anxious, it will be stating what their basic needs for attachment are, like how often they want to be together and stuff like that, and they negotiate where their needs are both being met. Probably the expert in this is the emotion-focused therapist, Sue Johnson, who wrote Love Sense and a lot of other books, and she integrates attachment theory with couples counseling and very often works with anxious avoidant couples. In general, from my perspective, the goal is to create enough feelings of security that the anxious person can state what they basically need. And then if the avoidant is not willing to meet those basic needs, then I have to help the anxious person essentially let go and move on to finding somebody who will meet her or his basic needs.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. I know you always say not to try to figure out your type, but I always do anyway, and I always end up feeling really confused because I identify with aspects of all three unhealthy attachment types. And I think probably for many of us, I know for me, you know, my parents were, I had different issues with each of them. So in the case of my father, he was very explosive and angry and unpredictable and had very low self-esteem and took it out in the form of control and shaming and these things. And on the other hand, my mom was extremely loving and supportive, coming from a place, though, often of anxiety and needing to control. And so there's a sense of smothering from that always. And so when we do exercises like trying to imagine what kind of care you'd like, often I'm, you know, the idea of, I come up with something, okay, accepting, but the idea of something embracing me or holding me feel, you know, it's just like, I don't want to be touched. But I have a hard time sometimes reconciling, well, okay, what kind of care or support do I really need? Because, and I see it come out differently in different genders. I mean, I see what I chase after with male authority figures or any, you know, or a male romantic situation versus pushing away females that are interested in spending time or connected. And over time, I mean, okay, knowing that, sometimes I can challenge myself to say, well, why don't you just say yes this time, or why don't you spend time even though you feel like pushing away? But it's been a lot of years, and I don't know that anything has changed that much. So I guess kind of what, you know, if you can't figure out exactly what you need, what are we doing with these types? You know what I mean?
Well, what we need is, first of all, just, it's not a rational, logical process. It's about reviewing, if we can, like, for instance, actual times we were in any kind of relationship, and when did we feel the most secure? How often was the person there? How often did we connect? Did we connect always in person or sometimes by phone? Was the connection 2 times, 3 times a week? If we've never had that, then we have to literally visualize, do an ideal relationship meditation where we visualize, imagine ourselves in a sort of domestic situation, doing something like sitting on a couch together on a Sunday, reading the Times, or cooking a meal together, or walking through a farmer's market, and just visualize how close would they be. Imagine when would this person be available and when would they not be present, and just allow, you're trying to integrate your right hemisphere, which has its attachment needs, but be able to verbalize it, and that requires your left brain being present. So you're either visualizing what would be the perfect relationship for you, or you're reflecting on elements of past relationships, times during which you felt secure. And then what we are doing is then being able to confidently, when we meet someone, express these needs. And that's what we talk about by needs. If we don't feel that there's been any movement forward, then really, of course, there's two different ways to create a greater sense of security. One is through finding a safe individual who we meet with reliably to essentially develop emotional co-regulation and disclosing and trust. That is very often therapeutic encounter or a counselor. It's what the work I do is. It's what the work of countless therapists and psychologists do and psychiatrists and psychoanalysts. It can be found in 12-step groups where there's a sponsor. If you find a sponsor who's reliably available and, you know, attentive and responds to a call and you work with them over time, then people start to get that felt sense of what it's like to have a secure relationship. And from that, they connect with that feeling in their body, the somatic feeling of what it's like to be secure with someone. And this is important. Then when we go out on a date, we stop looking for the experience of excitement, which is essentially recreating the anxious avoidant experience. And we start looking for, does this person create that same feeling of security that I feel when I'm with my sponsor or therapist or my best friend? You're looking for that openness, that relaxing of the stomach. Very often, people who grow up in unreliable caregiving environments, because the attachment is so sporadic, they chase excitement when they meet, and that's all they chase. But excitement is a somatic experience that never lasts. It's a very short experience. And when we chase after excitement, we're chasing after someone who will not be reliably available for us. So we want to shift the emphasis to look for the somatic markers of security. So if you can create the feelings in your body of what it's like to be with someone, a best friend, or anyone that you feel secure that you can share your emotions with and they won't judge you, then you start looking for that. Yeah, exactly. So one more, and then Kathy will make a brief announcement about what to expect when we come back from lunch.
Hello, my name is Duhirgwe, and I'm really grateful to be here, grateful to my friend for having shared this with me. I really got so much out of this, and I really, really appreciate really everyone's presence here. But I'm wondering, as I was listening to this, and I'm new to understanding, like, really, like, your philosophy, but also, and your writings, but also new to recovery, you know, I just happened to be. So I'm listening to this, and right away I got this idea, like, oh, I do have these avoidance, dismissive, I see this, though I also see, like, things, the anxious or anxiety bit. But I'm wondering if you could speak to this idea of it not just being like the caregiver, but also maybe place. Because the way that I grew up, I think that's what really created a lot of the insecurity, is like moving from, you know, one European place to Africa, to Texas, to New York, to Italy, like just moving around as a kid, like every 2 years, like I didn't have any like security in terms of grounding. And I feel like I have a lot of detachment and dismissive and avoidance because of this. So I'm wondering if you could speak to this idea of also environment creating this, not just the caregivers and the people around you, you know, mm-hmm. which in the end does, you know, you do end up like that. And for me, one of the things, the biggest thing I've seen in that is that, like, I'm 42 years old, I've never had a long-term, like, relationship, you know? Like, that's what I'm getting just as I'm listening. But anyways, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. So the right hemisphere is across all mammals. If you're a bird, your left brain is what looks for acquiring specific objects from the world, like food, like berries, or twigs to create a nest. And across all mammals, the subdominant right hemisphere of the brain looks just for right now, am I safe? Where are my flock? And essentially is very, very conscious of the context, the world around us. In the first few years of life, especially when the right hemisphere is being formed, not only are the attachments to specific figures, caregivers, fundamental in shaping our view of how safe we are with other people, what to expect from other human beings, will our emotions be seen and soothed, or will we be constantly on our own? But the infant is very, very also attuned to the specific place it lives in. Winnicott, the great child development theorist, talks about the transitional space and how the child needs this ongoing, reliable environment to which to develop achievements, new abilities to explore the world safely. If the environment changes too frequently, the child is deprived of the transitional space. And on top of that, very often caregivers doing the very best they can, but when they move and they dislocate, their lives are in upheaval and they don't have the attentional availability to see when the child is in distress or overwhelmed by new stimuli and cannot soothe the child. And so the effect can be, if there's a lot of displacement or moving or new shifts in life, then it can lead a lasting degree of insecure attachment. And of course, dismissive is one of the results. If the child didn't feel reliably the presence of a caregiver who could down-regulate her fear, her upset, her overwhelm to a state of, I'm safe here, where she's constantly has a figure available to introduce her to the new environment and play with her. Key to developing a transitional space is the presence of the other, the parent that will, with the child, work through the environment and help the child feel secure. So it's entirely very, very likely that a lot of displacements, if the parents are not fully available to help the child acclimate and develop a new play space where they feel secure, would lead to dysregulation and anxious attachment. And then in terms of doing the work, you would definitely want to try to internalize. Part of, whether it's through therapy or through 12-step, there's great programs like SLAA for people who struggle in relationships, or there's, and in Buddhist practice, using the ideal parent protocol, the visualizing what it would be like to be young, and when you shifted, moved, were relocated, what would it have been like to have a figure there present to have helped you feel safe? It doesn't mean we're rejecting our parents or we're saying they were bad or anything like that. We're just creating object constancy, the sense of security in us. You're creating that in your body. And then very often for dismissive people, they need to create a sense of what it's like to be with an attachment figure who'll leave them a lot of space so they can feel that they can get away when they need, but still have somebody safe to return to. So you visualize that, you get to know that feeling in your body, and you get to confidently express what your needs are when you meet someone.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org. www.ecosystemsmedia.org/donate.